government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion.
That's how much
bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are massive.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep?
Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion are those of the speakers.
On July 16th, RTP hosted a teleforum call titled The Federal Reserve and Real-Time Payment Systems. This great conversation about proposed new payment methods at the Federal Reserve featured insights from Aaron Klein of the Brookings Institution, George Selgin from the Cato Institute, and it was moderated by J.W. Verrett, Associate Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School. We hope you enjoy it.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Federal Society's Free Lunch Podcast for the Regulatory Transparency Project. My name is William Hild. I'm the Deputy Director of RTP. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the guest speakers on today's call. We've been looking forward to this afternoon's discussion entitled Federal Reserve's Role in Payment Systems. The Federal Reserve plays a central role in the nation's payment systems. Reserve banks keep currency in circulation to meet demand, provide check collection services to banks, operate payment systems, and provide financial services to the United States government and foreign institutions. The Federal Reserve is currently exploring ways to support faster payments in the United States. The potential actions would facilitate real-time interbank settlements of faster payments. Proponents feel the actions may assist smaller banks and credit unions to service local communities, while detractors raise concerns about interoperability, the ability to exchange messages among different instant payment systems, and other issues. This teleforum will address these issues and much more. Today we will explore whether we should maintain the status quo, seek to scale back existing regulation, and or winnow existing regulatory regimes. We are joined today by Aaron Klein, Fellow in Economic Studies and Policy Director at the Center on Regulation and Markets at the Brookings Institution, George Selgin, Senior Fellow and Director of the Center for Monetary and Financial Alternatives at the Cato Institute, and our moderator, J.W. Verrett, Associate Professor of Law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason University. If you would like to learn more about Aaron, George, or JW and their interesting work, please visit fedsoc.org, where we've listed their full bios. I will turn it over first to JW to get us started. After opening remarks and discussion between our speakers, we will go to audience Q&A. So audience members, please think of what you'd like to ask our speakers.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the Federal Society for organizing this great teleforum event. Welcome George and Aaron, and welcome all of our listeners. And yes, please do think of a good question. We'll go through a series of discussions, a round of opening statements, and then a round of rebuttal or further discussion. One of the interesting things about this topic is that it leads to all sorts of interesting items for debate, but also items of agreement. And for listeners who want to learn more, I would recommend a debate between George and Aaron and James Angel that was hosted by the Mercatus Center's Bridge website, where they've gone into a written debate about these issues and found a lot of room for common ground. So just to go through the reason why we're here and the issue we're here to discuss briefly before we begin with some comments from Aaron, most people know the Federal Reserve for monetary policy, and a few people know the fact that the Federal Reserve also serves as a banking regulator, but probably the least well-known role that the Federal Reserve plays is its role in the payment system, in the clearance and settlement of payments between banks. And that role is very unique insofar as the Federal Reserve both operates a number of payment systems and operates them in, I think it's fair to say, through the use of some technology that's fairly antiquated. And the Federal Reserve also regulates a competing, at times competing, payment system run by the Clearinghouse Association, a group of large banks. So where we are now in this role the Federal Reserve has a statutory obligation to manage any conflicts as best they can. A recent GAO report looks at questions about whether the Federal Reserve manages those conflicts sufficiently and offers thoughts on either side, useful for either side of that debate. And furthermore, the Federal Reserve has an obligation to recoup the costs it incurs in running the system and has an obligation to ensure that it's only providing payment services that are not otherwise provided by the market. So the Federal Reserve issued a call in January asking for sort of setting off a public debate about how the Federal Reserve should move toward real-time payments, toward a sort of a modernization of the payment system to track what's going on in other countries, things that Europe has been able to do, and things that if you're both operating on the network, things you can already achieve in other things like PayPal. So the Federal Reserve issued this call for comment, and one of the points of debate that has crystallized is should the Federal Reserve be the leader in the move toward a real-time payment system, or should the Fed stay out of the way and allow the TCH system to thrive as the future of real-time payments? Along the way in that debate, there's also all sorts of interesting points of agreement in the need for action that, again, I would recommend those that want to learn more take a look at the fascinating back and forth between George and Aaron and James Angel on the Mercatus Center's bridge discussion between these folks. So without any further ruining of the ending here, I want to open up to Aaron and give Aaron 5 to 10 minutes of discussion. Then we'll move to George and back and forth. And then again, don't forget your fascinating questions from the audience. So Aaron, go ahead.
Thank you very much, JW, and thank you very much to Society for hosting this. I am thrilled to see the rise in interest in real-time payments. And I want to take a moment to frame this issue because to me, this is an issue about income inequality. It is the simplest policy solution to address the problems of income inequality without getting into government taxes, spending, any other types of marginal incentives or distortions. It's an income inequality issue because it addresses a fundamental problem in society today, which is it's very expensive to be poor. A lot of the high costs that low-income people face for services that higher-income people either don't need, don't have, or don't think of involve banking, financial services, and access to your own funds. And to me, real-time payments is the single largest one. Let me start with a story. I take my kids ice skating on Saturday mornings, and afterwards we go to the bank. I do my little basic banking on a Saturday morning. Kids get lollipops, maybe put in their piggy bank into their passbook savings account. And the one Saturday morning, there are three people in the bank, myself, two other people. The woman at the teller is getting very agitated. What do you mean my check won't clear until Wednesday or Thursday? But it's my money, but it's here, but you know me, but this check is good. It's my regular check. Well, but I have deposits. Withdrawals coming, automatic. What's going to happen? $35? She's referencing the overdraft fee for going below. Well, is that just – well, I have multiple. $35 each time? She's getting more and more agitated as she appreciates that when you approach the zero lower bound of your bank account, the costs and fees associated with that rise very substantially very quickly. And this delay between when she's depositing her money on a Saturday and when the money will be available Wednesday to Thursday, the bank doesn't even know, is leaving her in this lurch of clearly getting to zero. And as she's getting more and more upset with the teller, who's a very nice lady who I've known for years, nothing's moving. And everything's kind of at gridlock. And I'm kind of looking at this thinking, well, this is interesting. I never thought of these three or four delays. I never thought about when my payment cleared is mattering for my ability to make ends meet. But clearly it does to her. All of a sudden, the other woman in line walks over and says, I can help you. And says, what you need to do is take this to a check casher around the corner and come back with cash. The woman says to the teller, when would the cash be available? And the teller says, well, immediately. Would say, oh, my God, thank you so much. Where's the check cashier? She gives the description. And a few lights went off in my mind. First, this is a completely rational use of check cashing. Check cashier will probably cost her $20. Each overdraft costs $35. So you can see the return on investment to check cashing. Two, the stories we hear about the use of check cashing or payday lending, another alternative she could have gone to, is that it's about the unbanked. Well, wait a second. Number one, everybody in the story is banked. Number two, statistically, we know that the unbanked are about 7% of the population, and the underbanked, defined as using a check cashier, payday lender, or international wire service, are 20 to 25%. So there are three times as many underbanked as unbanked people. Two, you hear a story, oh, that's about the branch not being local, not being convenient, or the hours don't work. Wait a second, we're talking about a person who's right there on a Saturday morning at the teller. And it dawns on me that this is actually a very prevalent story. Another way to look at, say, well, Aaron, that's a nice anecdote you have. But a different way to look at it is there are three people in a bank on a Saturday morning. One person has the problem. The other person clearly has had the problem and solved it. And the third person thinks he's a banking expert. When you start digging into this, you realize that $35 billion a year is spent in overdraft. $25 billion in payday, and $7 billion in check cashing. That combines to $67 billion. Would real-time payments solve all of that? No, it probably wouldn't even solve a majority of it. But if it solves something like 20% of that, that's $13 billion a year of pure income transfer from lower-income people who are at the zero lower bound of their bank account to bank and financial services profits. It's no coincidence that a small regional bank CEO was in the paper for having his yacht named Overdraft. It's a huge source of revenue. And it also explains some of the political opposition we'll get to later. So I started writing about this and digging into it in 2015-16. The story and the question JW asked to start us off, which is, should the Fed be a leader in this? Turns out, the Fed cannot be a leader in this because the leadership occurred decades ago. In 2004, Mexico instituted real-time payments. In 2007, the Bank of England instituted real-time payments throughout the entire United Kingdom. Currently, the European Union has real-time payments. You can deposit a payment from Latvia in Ireland faster than you can from Connecticut to Minneapolis. Had the Federal Reserve been a leader when it had an opportunity in 2007 and deployed the technology, which, trust me, if the Bank of England can do it, the Federal Reserve can do it, we would have had real-time payments for 12 years. Let's go back and do the math. I said there's about a $13 billion a year cost or savings that would have been instituted at my 20% just for those three fees. Right? There are other fees. There are late fees. There are interest fees. There are a series of other fees people deal with because their money gets caught in this delay. Multiply that over 12 and 13 years, and you're approaching $200 billion of money that has been transferred from lower-income people, working families, into financial institutions, not just banks, check cashers, payday lenders, et cetera, of profit. Because the money was there and available. So what to do about it? The Federal Reserve has embarked on a process designed to accomplish nothing. They ignored the issue for years while the Bank of England was doing this. As JW properly pointed out, the Fed's incentive structure and focus is on monetary policy first, second, and third. Maybe bank regulation, you can debate whether it's third or fourth on the list. Payments is distant and below. And even though the Fed has published a substantial amount of economic research and given many of the members and of the Board of Governors and regional banks have discussed and bemoaned the problems associated with income inequality, the Fed has broadly ignored the policy solution lever that it could implement to reduce it. Eventually, you get to this point where the chorus gets a little bit too loud and the Fed forms a faster payments task force of 332 people. This must make Kafka chuckle. because he's the only other person I could imagine who would have thought that it made sense when a government wants to figure out how to do something faster to form a task force of 332 people. Shockingly, 332 people in a task force did not definitively come up with how to do something faster. And more studies and calls and distant visions for 2020, solution by 2020, were put out. In the interim, the private sector has actually solved the problem. The RTP has come together, put this out, and there is a real-time payment system in the United States. The Fed is still studying the issue. They put out this notice for comments that were due in January. It has gone from snowing to 100 degrees outside, and the Fed is still reading their comments. Just this past week, Fed Chairman Powell acknowledged that the Fed will not have hit their 2020 deadline, ensuring that they are unable to do something the Bank of England did 13 years earlier. From my standpoint, let me put forward what my preferred solution is, since I've spent some time laying out the problem and why I think it's so significant. The Federal Reserve has regulatory authority under the Electronic Funds Availability Act and under the Check 21 Act, an act I helped draft when I was in Congress, to mandate clearing time for payments in accordance with available technology. The Federal Reserve today could amend their existing regulations and simply require payments be available immediately. This would give financial institutions choices. One, they could partner with the RTP that currently would provide that service to them. Or two, they could make funds available and wait for the funds to settle through their existing slower payment rails. That would be the financial institution's choice. Many institutions already provide availability immediately. Often, however, that service is only given to their members who have a lot of money in their account. Ironically, those for whom it's not so important to get real-time funds availability, nor those who will generate fees by their lack of availability. So there is nothing precluding the Fed from mandating real-time payments tomorrow, which would be my preferred solution. Whether or not the Fed needs to build another system, they can continue to debate that with their giant task forces designed to figure out how to do things quicker. I think there's a real danger to a failure to act, to punting this debate until the Fed builds a system, which they've not shown themselves capable of doing for well over a decade. And every delay of a day exacerbates this problem. I'll close with one fact that we should all be able to agree on, which was Friday was June 28th. If you were paid on Friday, June 28th, how did you access your money before the first of the month? How much would that have cost you to access your money before the first of the month? That cost is large, substantial, and borne by those who could least afford it, and is easily solvable in today's technological and regulatory environment. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Aaron. And it's worth noting just quickly, when Jay Powell was on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, and he was essentially the one Republican member of the board, they wanted to give him something to do, but they didn't want to give him anything too important to do. And so they put him in charge of the payment system committee of the board. That might be my editorial interpretation of it, but that was one of his primary responsibilities before he became chairman. In any event, that trivia aside, George Selgin from the Cato Institute. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. And thanks to RTP for this opportunity to talk about this important issue. And Aaron, I must thank you as well for that wonderful overview of the problem. It certainly is an extremely important problem. And Aaron stressed the effects on the underbanked as well as the unbanked, of course. But this really is costly to everybody. Merchants bear a lot of the costs of slow payments, particularly when they take the risk of assuming they're going to get a proper settlement, and yet it takes a few days before they know for sure. So fast payments have a lot, there's a lot at stake here for all kinds of people. I actually, listening to Aaron, found very little to disagree with in all that he said. This doesn't surprise me particularly. There was one area where I found a little point of disagreement, so I'll mention that and then I'll explain why I disagree. And that has to do with the question of whether the Fed could simply solve this problem by mandating that fast payments be provided. And it doesn't have to, in the meantime, make up its mind about whether to provide its own fast payment system, the so-called RTGS, or real-time gross settlement system. I actually think that there's a tension there, and I'll come around to it. But let me first talk a little bit about how I see the private sector solution that's been developed by RTP, since they're our hosts. The Fed did finally get around to forming this Faster Payments Task Force, and the general spirit of that exercise, begun several years ago, was one in which the Fed challenged the private sector actors involved in the task force to come up with solutions to the faster payments problem. And there were a number of criteria that had to be addressed for an actual solution to have been arrived at, one of which was this notion of ubiquity of payments. The idea was that the Fed wanted to see ultimately a system in which the entire network of potential payment makers would be covered. So I could be writing a check for anybody else or making a payment for anybody else in the economy, and we would have this network that would allow that to be a fast payment no matter who I was and who the recipient of the payment was. That's what's meant by ubiquity, is universal or near universal membership of this system. In any event, RTP did rise to the challenge, that is, the clearinghouse rose to the challenge and came up with this RTP network. And I want to talk a little bit about it because it's actually remarkably low tech when you get right down to it. What's involved in this arrangement is simply that there's a special account at the Federal Reserve Bank that is a jointly owned account, that is, all the participants, all the banks that choose to take part in RTP, they all are joint owners of this one account, and they have to contribute funds to the account. And they have to have a certain balance there that they maintain, a minimum balance. And then for all those participating in the network and their clients, or if they're banks, the people who have business, have deposits at those banks, can make payments to anyone who is associated with another bank, and those payments are settled on the books of that account. So it's all done electronically and instantly within that one account. As it were, these participants are all taking part in a central clearing facility that does everything, and the Fed doesn't have to intervene at all. Its involvement, the Federal Reserve comes into the story when the participants have to top off their accounts, put more money in to make sure they have enough to cover any transactions that come through. Under the present Federal Reserve arrangement, they can do that any time during the day. They can't top off their accounts 24 hours or on weekends because the Fed's own system isn't operating then. The Fed could improve the functioning of the system by making its own settlement services available 24 hours a day. That would make this system work better. But even as it stands, it offers possibility of fast, practically instantaneous payments for all the people who are participants. So it's very simple, and so far it's got a fairly large membership. The problem is it's not ubiquitous until practically all the banks join in, and then non-banks can be participants indirectly by making arrangements with the banks that agree to participate in the system. in order for it to be ubiquitous, of course, everybody has to join, or a lot of banks have to join. And this is where the question of the Fed's role comes in. Because until, I think about a year ago now, almost a year, until a year ago or so, the Fed didn't seem inclined to enter into the business of providing its own real-time gross settlement system, which would be a direct competitor with the RTP system that was already up and running. Therefore, any bank that wanted to offer fast payment services could have a strong incentive to take part in the RTP arrangement. And they were joining, and they continue to join. But as soon as the Fed announced, I think to the surprise of many people, that it was now contemplating putting in its own real-time settlement system, that had a chilling effect on the private sector solution that was already up and running. And that the reason for that is that basically now you have a prospect of an alternative, potentially incompatible real-time or fast payments network. So any financial institution that had not already signed up for the RTP network had to ask itself a question. Is this the network that's ultimately going to prevail, or should I sign up for the Fed network? Rather than wanting to sign up for both and expend the fixed costs involved, a lot of institutions are now playing wait and see. They want to know what the Fed's going to do. So that gets me back to the original point I made about with regard to what Aaron had said. The very fact that the Fed is contemplating entering this space, not just as a regulator, but as a direct provider of fast payment services, that very fact is preventing RTP from acquiring the ubiquity that it is supposed to be able to acquire if it's going to solve the problem posed by the Fed several years ago. On the other hand, of course, the Fed's own system won't be offering any fast payment services until the Fed begins to set it up. And the expectation is that the Fed couldn't possibly complete its own real-time gross settlement system for several years. It's a big deal to set up that kind of system, which, by the way, is much more technically challenging than the simple arrangement RTP has. So there is a lot more doubt about whether it could be set up even in 4 years' time, and whether it will work as it's supposed to, and whether the risks it entails, which in some ways are more serious than those of RTP, will be properly contained. So basically, if the Fed wants to achieve fast payments by 2020 or right away, immediately with a mandate, it really has to get out of the way. That is, it cannot at the same time say to the public, to the banks, okay, you have to have fast payments in place by the end of this year, say, while also continuing to dangle out the possibility of establishing a rival fast payment system some years in the future. That will put all the financial institutions in a very awkward place. Well, they might be compelled to give immediate credit for payments, for example, as a way to address the mandate without having to invest in a fast payments network that might turn out to be defunct several years from now. But that means that they'd be assuming a lot of settlement risk, which is very dangerous. So I don't think, in other words, that we want to force banks to move quickly into a fast payments solution until they can see a clear way to do that without taking undue risks, whether of fixed cost investments or of settlements. So my belief is that since the RTP system is up and running, the rational thing for the Fed to do, since it encouraged this solution to begin with, is to work with RTP to see to it that the system is managed in a way that's in the interest of all the participants, to make sure that the fees that have been set, which presently seem very reasonable and, if anything, somewhat indulgent to the smaller participants, to see to it that that fee structure stays in place. I don't think there's anything wrong in principle with treating RTP as a kind of a utility and regulating it if necessary. But I think that the present ambiguous position of the Fed, where it might offer a rival product, I think that has is contrary to the goal of establishing a fast payments arrangement as quickly as possible that would satisfy all of the original goals the Fed had when it started this process to begin with.
All right, thank you, George. I just to offer some of my own perspective, I spent 2 years on the Hill running a Federal Reserve oversight project for the last financial services chairman, and I learned what a Sisyphean task congressional oversight of the Fed is, and I think probably the only thing I accomplished in those 2 years was getting the GAO report looking at the Federal Reserve's role in the payment system and whether they adequately manage conflicts of interest that the Federal Reserve faces in running the payment system. And that was a great GAO report for those who want to learn more about this topic. And in the end, I think the GAO tees up the potential conflicts and does not really come to a definitive conclusion on whether the Fed's adequately policing those conflicts. Aaron, I realize your preferred solution is a mandate on real-time payments. Is George's perspective compatible with yours? Would you like to see that plus George's view that the Fed should step back from the potential to compete with the private sector, or is it incompatible?
So it is George's view is probably the logical outcome of adopting my position, but I wouldn't preclude it the way that George would. So let me try to pick up a couple of his threads and then also flag a couple areas that he raised that I didn't, where I want to be in violent agreement, particularly as it relates to the Fed's requirement to make their own Fed wire, which is the intrabank settlement system, the non-consumer facing. We've been talking about the automated clearinghouse or ACH system. Fed wire needs to be made 365, 724, 365, and it is an embarrassment that it is not. It is, again, there's no good reason. It precludes not only in properly handling the commercial payment system, it also is a reason why stocks still take 2 days to clear. I mean, it's absurd that stock trades have been reduced from 3 days to 2 days. Nobody notices these underpinning issues until there's a giant problem. But I think it's not too hard to imagine, particularly as one thinks about cyber risks, the inherent vulnerabilities of having these delayed systems. The Fed ought to immediately make their Fed wire 24/7, 365, and they've offered no reason why. In fact, the Fed's been so secretive about Fed wire when it went out, there was an outage earlier that the Fed itself didn't even acknowledge for quite a while. Finally, it did under questioning. As it gets to George made a comment about settlement risk. That is, if a bank makes available, and let me be clear, we're talking about customers that have had existing prior relationships, and I'm talking about amounts in the first $3,000 to $5,000. So there is no new person who sets up an account with $1 million check and wants to deposit it and abscond with it right away. We're talking about relatively small dollar amounts for existing customers. I don't think there's much settlement risk. I think the experience of credit unions and others in this space of providing real-time funds availability shows that there's extremely limited settlement risk. But if there is, if settlement risk is a thing, and I'm wrong, and George is right, then banks should go to the RTP system so that they're given a choice with this immediate mandate. If settlement risk is a thing in perception or reality, clear with RTP. If you want to clear with RTP because it's better, quicker, faster, do it. If for some reason you prefer the existing ACH antiquated system, then you have to take on the settlement risk. So be it. I think the real issue is not the settlement risk, but the loss of overdraft fee revenue. That's the real source of opposition that driving things. And I just don't see much settlement risk in this customer base in this amount. I think where I think I'm in agreement with George is I think the vast majority of institutions, if presented with my actual mandate, if the Fed took that, which was in my comment letter, and applied it, I think that's exactly what would happen. People would move into the real-time settlement business, and there wouldn't be a need. The Fed wouldn't end up building a system which it couldn't possibly, I think 5 years is an optimistic time frame. In my Maslow's hierarchy of priorities, priority one is having immediate funds availability as quickly as possible, because every month, every week, every pay period we wait drains money out of the pockets of those who can least afford it. And so my hierarchy is not having a second system, having a governmental system. My hierarchy is the immediacy of fixing this problem, and the shame that the Fed and others should have in not having fixed this problem when England did it. So I don't think it's that much of a concern. I do give George's point on interoperability more credence than I do on settlement risk. Europe has now been in a system where they now have two real-time payment systems operating simultaneously. Paradoxically, that violates one of the Fed's own recommendations from their task force. So given the existence of a system, the technological problems with interoperability of multiple real-time settlements, and the Fed's own stated priority list, it would feel to me weird for them to build another system. But my priority is in giving people access to their own money immediately and reducing the cost of accessing to their funds. And I view this as such an urgent problem that solving it immediately is far more important than figuring out who's providing the service.
Well, if I can respond, I think what Aaron's saying, all of it makes sense. Really, there are carrot and the stick solution that are probably in practice quite equivalent. The stick is to say everybody has to get into provide fast payments right now or very soon. The carrot is just for the Fed to say, okay, we're not going to introduce our own RTGS system, so don't bother waiting for it. It's not coming. I think they both have the same or very similar effects of driving everyone into the RTP arrangement. The only residual concern I have about the stick solution, the mandate, is the perhaps very small possibility that having instituted the mandate, having given all the financial institutions an incentive to probably move into RTP or make other arrangements, that the Fed would still continue to contemplate intervening and might in fact intervene in the future and set up its own network, which would be very wasteful, of course, and would create problems with the lack of interoperability of the two systems. Now, I don't know if they would dare to bother doing that, especially if the RTP system is working fine, but it could be something of a concern for those who invest in the existing RTP arrangement, that they could find themselves having made all those investments and only to have this competitor appear on the scene in the future and shake things up. I don't know how important that is, but I think it's a bit of a problem.
Well, I'm glad to see, you know, in a world where we're becoming more and more polarized and disagreeing, I think one thing that can bring us often all together is mutual critique of the Federal Reserve. And I think that's an underdeveloped way to build bridges. We're going to start taking calls, start taking questions from the audience. And as that gets working, as folks think about their questions and hit the appropriate button to chime in, I'll give an opportunity to our two panelists. If they want to ask questions directly, please go ahead.
Okay. Yes, the question I have is a general one. Can everybody hear me? You know, since there's all this concern about the big concern about RTP, of course, is that, well, they have a pretty good deal they're offering now. The rate structure seems very fair and competitive compared to what other relatively fast payment systems charge and all that. But what if they change it in the future and that turns out to be a raw deal? And this is a legitimate concern. The question I have is, why couldn't the RTP account be a mutual, be managed like a mutual? That would do away with all these concerns. And I wonder if anyone has given any thoughts to that as an alternative to having to contemplate the possibility of future regulation of RTP as a kind of public utility. Anyone have any thoughts? Aaron, do you have any thoughts about that?
It's an interesting question. I have kind of long puzzled with this tension that the central bank has a role to play in payments clearing and settlement, but has a core tension between being an operator and a regulator. Mm-hmm. You know, often we put operational and regulatory authority together and then are surprised when tensions are mounted. One of the breakthroughs, I think, in bank regulation, which took quite a while and had a lot of problems to get there, was segregating the role of the deposit guarantor, and that way really the operator of the institution with bankruptcy and the entity that's on the hook, with the primary regulator. I realize the FDIC is the primary regulator for thousands of state non-member banks, but the reality is the larger financial institutions tend to have a different primary regulator, and they have the insurer as a backup regulator, in large part because we saw the tension inherent when the regulator was also the person on the hook. And so I think the Fed has suffered greatly from this tension between its proper role in regulating the system and operating the system. If the Fed had been following the statutory intent of Congress, it would have mandated real-time payments as soon as the technology became widely available. I used the Bank of England in 2007, understanding Poland, Mexico, South Africa, and Japan all did it well before. So I'm not aspiring for the Fed to be a leader, just not the ultimate lagger, global lagger.
Yeah.
And I think the reason they didn't was that their ACH system wouldn't comply and they didn't want to modernize it. Mm-hmm. And they haven't invested the serious resources, energy to modernizing their own system, nor have we now learned do they plan to, even on their own date that their task force set for them. So I'm sympathetic, George, to your point and to the broader point, which is that you should task an entity with being the regulator or being the operator. But tasking the same entity with doing both is an inherent conflict.
You know, what you're saying, Aaron, makes me think about an analogy where suppose that years ago when the government started imposing emission controls, and they had a mandate essentially like analogous to what you're talking about. They said, look, you've got to reduce emissions on automobiles by such and such an amount. Figure out how to do it. Okay, you have until this date. Imagine that if this, at the same time they said, Oh, and by the way, we might get into the car business ourselves and see if we can do it better. this is the sort of situation, I think, that in a way is what we have today, where the Fed is wants to see something happen, but at the same time is thinking of doing it on its own instead of having the private sector do it. And I think it has to make up its mind.
Well, isn't it even more, doesn't it also even complicate that the Fed has a third role, too, as a lender of last resort to the rival payment system?
Yes, I think that can pose a problem. But I think in the area of real-time fast payments, a greater concern is that problem shows up most in the possibility that the Fed will, engage in emergency lending of a sort to operate real-time payments as a way of avoiding liquidity problems. The way they run their wholesale real-time payments is essentially with intraday credits, and that has been a problem in the past. And it's a way to spare the bank's high liquidity needs while pretending to be doing real-time payments. I don't know if they do that sort of thing with the RTGS system, but it could be a possible problem.
As we're still waiting for questions to come in from the audience, I have a thought in my mind. I'm wondering, I'd like to learn more about from George and Aaron, if there are existing inefficiencies in the system that profit a number of current bank providers of overdraft services, what's the economic story behind why it became profitable to develop real-time payments in the clearinghouse system? Well, why did that? What shifted?
Well, I think there are a couple. Let me say a couple of things, right? Which is that, and this is part of the value of appreciating the financial services is fundamentally, like most industries in this society, it's global. Even service industries are inherently global. And it doesn't take much to see the writing on the wall that rents are not going to last forever. This technology is becoming widely available, and people will seek cheaper alternatives. Number one, lots of institutions, can charge for expedited funds availability. But two, more importantly, it provides your customers a niche in need, and it can allow you to attract new customers. Large financial institutions have been attracting new customers faster than small financial institutions, so it can be a comparative advantage in that dimension. And it can also help ward off alternative systems and competition. I think the backdrop today of the Facebook Libra hearings starting on the Hill are a reminder that the payment system has been part of the banking system for a very long time. That's not a legal requirement. That's because it's made economic sense. Our entire legal and regulatory regime on banking is geared towards the taking of deposits and the provision of credit, not the processing of payments. And as we think about the separation between banking and commerce in the United States, whatever your view on it, take it as a given. Payments has been assumed to be on the banking side of that ledger. That's an assumption not required by law. And somebody else who builds a better payment trap could create migration there with a whole host of negative knock-on effects. So I think the industry, was wise to try and get out ahead of the curve and meet existing consumer demand. And also, I think in part was building this because they appreciate the value and economic returns of the payment system. And if you don't update it, eventually somebody will. And that somebody doesn't have to be a bank.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree with Aaron on this. I think it's a mistake to see the banks having acted as much as they have simply because the Fed encouraged them to. That was part of the story, but the increased contestability of the payment system market that part of it that the banks were involved in has been a very important force. And we've seen a lot of developments of alternative fast payment systems. They haven't been ubiquitous systems, but they've chipped away at the market for payments held by the banks enough to themselves be a source of considerable pressure for the banks to up their act and offer their own rival faster payment services. So a lot of what's happening in this space is not being driven by the Fed's mandates or task forces, but by the global and technological developments that would leave the banks behind if they didn't improve their act.
All right. If we have no questions yet, I'll continue my edification. Why has this been possible in other countries but not in the United States? Is it a question of the alignment of vested interests, different regulatory environment, a less powerful entrenched central bank than what we have here? What's the reason why the Bank of England beat us so badly on this race to real time?
If I may, I think part of the reality there is that there was a lot more complacency in the U.S. than in other places. I'm not sure if England is the best example here, but we had an okay payment system compared to legacy payment system compared to many parts of the world, and that provided meant for a less of a sense of urgency to improve our system. In the meantime, some places that had terrible legacy payment systems have passed us by in many respects with regard to fast payments. We see this particularly with the mobile payments, how we've fallen behind. But some of the places that have gone furthest there are the places that really had very few old-fashioned, decent payments alternatives. So I think that's part of the story is we didn't have the worst system to begin with, though it's not the whole story by any means.
I think George is right that having a system that works, and I think part of the reticence the Fed has had is their system works. A new system is not 100% guaranteed to not have a hiccup. And their fear of having a hiccup, coupled with their blinders as to who bears the cost of the slow system, have contributed to complacency.
Well, not necessarily blinders, but the plain old public choice considerations that the people bearing the costs are not the ones who carry the clout.
That's right. And in addition, it's regulatory will. I mean, I've talked with Paul Tucker from the Bank of England, who led the program, and it was a hard slog. You had to dedicate time, energy, and effort at a very senior level. Now, you know, 2007 is an interesting year that the Bank of England rolled it out online. One can understand our central bank being preoccupied in 07, 08, 09. By the time you get to 10, 11, 12, 13, they're spending way more time thinking about the zero lower bound of monetary policy than ever contemplating the zero lower bound of consumers' bank accounts.
It looks like we do have one question. So if that's all right, I'm going to hop in real here and unmute their line.
Yes, please.
Caller, your line's been unmuted. You have the floor.
Hello. My name's Teresa. I'm from Northeast Ohio. And my question, I guess, is for Mr. Klein. One of my concerns is that part of the reason that the UK has been able to go to real time is they only have 300 banking financial institutions, whereas the US has over 4,500 FDIC institutions, let alone our credit unions and our smaller institutions.
Yes.
Would the real-time mandate require mergers, which would give consumers less choice?
Absolutely not. There's no merger. This is a common misnomer. If you run a computer network and you can wire 300 computers, you can wire 5,000 computers. The number of institutions is irrelevant to solving the problem. It doesn't matter. In addition, it actually you don't require mergers. By the way, the idea that mergers result in less choice is another highly debatable phenomenon, in the sense that does the availability from Northeast Ohio of a very small bank with one branch in Natchez, Louisiana, create more or less choice for you, or is it irrelevant? Does a financial institution that exists online with no physical branches provide you choice and options? But there, this idea that there's a technological solution that can provide real-time payments for 300 banks but not for 3,000 fails to understand the technological problem at play. And it's one, by the way, I might say the president of the Philadelphia Federal Reserve gave that rationale to me when I asked him the same question, to which I responded, how many employees do you have wired on the regional bank of Philadelphia's email system? Does it harm you that, you know, does that mean that you can't do what the regional bank of San Francisco does because they have more employees? Or is there some technology that they can have that you can't have? So this canard is out there and has been promoted and received some attention at very high levels. But when you break it down, there's nothing technologically magic about the number of institutions. And furthermore, you know, when you do look at share of institution profit generated by overdraft, you find some correlations possibly in the other direction. I would note as a last point that many of the institutions that provide real-time funds availability are smaller institutions. And so this idea that smaller institutions would be disadvantaged, which I think smaller institutions to some degree have appreciated that one way they can compete in the current environment is providing faster funds availability because they know their customer and their community a little bit better than a large institution. The problem is that has to be done on an ad hoc basis, and that creates its own more complex regime.
Yeah, I would add to that that only one other consideration: if a fast payments system is very costly, if it involves a lot of upfront fixed costs to join, that of course could make it somewhat relatively disadvantageous for smaller institutions. So there, though, the point is, well, you want the most efficient fast payment system possible, so it's not overly burdensome. But if there are economies of scale that give some advantage to somewhat larger institutions, that's not necessarily a reason to regret having the system operate. It's just one of many economic considerations that will inform the optimal scale of different banks. I think the RTP system is actually pretty cheap to join. My guess is the real-time gross settlement, from everything I've read, the Fed's prospective system would probably have some more fixed costs, if I'm not mistaken.
We're nearing the end of our allotted time for the call, but I wanted to give all of our participants an opportunity to offer up any final thoughts.
Well, I'm glad to find myself in considerable agreement with Aaron on these issues. I think that the thing that we have to ask is whether the private sector network can be a long-term solution where nobody feels that they're getting a bad deal from it, where there's no sense of abuse of any kind of network externalities, or et cetera. Once banks are in this network, of course, they're going to have a powerful reason to stay in it. I think we should be talking about how the private sector network can be kept honest and fair to its members, and that would be a much more useful discussion at this point than one about whether the Fed should create its own network or not. I think that if we want to have a speedy solution to the fast payments problem, we should be encouraging the solution that's already up and running and thinking about how to make sure it works out as well as possible for all parties concerned. I think that would be the right thing to be the focus of discussion going forward.
I think listeners should appreciate the wide differing views, political views, theoretic views, views about the role of government, but can all reach agreement that a real-time payment system is the most efficient, effective way, tool out there with broad support to address the core problem of income inequality. Why is it so expensive to access your own funds when you need them immediately? As in economics, we talk about the elasticity of demand, and we often assume away the time dimension of the elasticity of needing funds. That is, we assume people have access to liquidity and funds when they need them and they can smooth their consumption. But in the real world, somebody got paid on Friday, June 28th, and they had to make their rent, they had to make their payments, they maybe had to make their child support. They had all these things they had to do on the first of the month. And by the way, these delays snowball in the real world. If it takes me 3 days to cash my check and then I have to give child support and that's another 3 days to transfer, now it's 6 days backed up before the money's in the account, that needs it. These things snowball, and there's no reason. These are legacy systems who there's been a neglect, whether benign or not, to update. Technology has simple solutions. One would think, regardless of where one comes from on the political spectrum, a solution that creates more efficiency and empowers people to access their own funds faster, saving them billions of dollars in the aggregate, tens of billions of dollars a year, ought to be one of the low-hanging fruit, easiest no-brainer in policy. And so I'm thrilled that groups like the Federalist Society and can bring together divergent sets of opinions to get into the weeds on a topic that often we don't think much about. But critical thought and analysis can highlight and hopefully pressure the one entity who has the capability to act and solve this problem very simply.
That's a good note on which to end, Aaron. And I certainly hope that folks from the Federal Reserve are listening into the podcast. We'll make sure to email them, forward it to them. It's been a great hour today. I've learned a lot. And as has been mentioned before, it's always fun when we can bring folks from different perspectives of the world of policy debate together, because we've mostly found a tremendous amount of agreement today. So it's been a great discussion. Thanks to both of you for joining us for that. And thanks so much to the Federal Society.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Free Lunch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.